Welcome to the EFCA Network podcast, where our mission is to spread encouragement and best practices among the Evangelical Free Church and our movement. I'm joined today by Tammy Metters, one of my teammates on the network board, and then my friend Mike Whalen, who is a CPA and a tax accountant, and he has helped me many times. I think, Mike, you have to remind me when we started. I feel like you helped me way back when I was a youth pastor. And you have to remind me even how we connected and stuff. But Tammy, set up this episode as we're going to talk a little bit about taxes and housing allowance and some of the nuts and bolts of this. So bring us into your experience and some of the questions you had.
Yeah, so I'm Tammy Metters, and I serve at a church in Charlotte, North Carolina. And after I became licensed through the EFCA, then I was eligible to receive the housing allowance. And then it just started this very bumpy journey for me, figuring out how much to estimate for housing allowance, all of the different tax things, finding, you know, someone, a tax accountant who was familiar with a housing allowance and the designation of clergy. So for me, it was really bumpy. There was a bump when I first estimated what my housing allowance would be. And then I hit another bump when I was trying to find someone to do my taxes. And it just kind of felt like new pastors, new clergy can have some direction here. Like, it would have been nice to have a little direction here. So that's how this conversation started. And we're so grateful to you, Michael, for just spending some time with us and giving us some direction here.
Well, and my big challenge personally too was just when I moved to Charlotte, where I eventually, you know, met Tammy and we started working together, I didn't estimate my quarterly taxes well. And that just ended up being a hardship for our family as April comes around. And so that's kind of the practical side for me. But Mike, introduce yourself and just share kind of how you got into this and sure. Some of your background. I know you've been doing this for a while, but tell everybody a little bit about yourself and then just walk us into this topic and help pastors and ministry leaders try and navigate some of these decisions.
Sure. Well, thanks for the opportunity today to talk a little bit about this. And we'll try not to get too deep into things, but I'll try to give you enough of a working background so you'll know enough to be able to navigate through some of these rules. I'm a CPA. I've been in practice since the mid-80s. I have a master's in tax. I work a lot with ministers and nonprofits over the years. And I can tell you that just almost as a general rule in my experience in working with small churches, many aren't familiar with it. So your situation is very common, Tammy. They aren't familiar with how the W-2 is presented. They're not familiar with how the housing allowance works. They're not necessarily required to tell you what qualifies as a housing expense, but nonetheless, most churches are not familiar with these rules, and they look for outside help to give them guidance. I think the first place to start really is, you know, who qualifies as a minister and is able to take advantage of excluding from income the housing allowances or housing expenses, I should say. And that really depends on the church. That's a decision they make. Generally, you have to be licensed or ordained or commissioned. It's a kind of a, I don't know if it's a state by state issue, but my experience has been that most churches will certainly look in and if they've got a pastor who is recently graduated from, say, Trinity International University, and they're licensed and ordained, and they've checked all the boxes, that's a pretty straightforward one. I have seen situations where at some of the larger Christian universities where some of the teachers are considered ministers. So that's probably out there on the fringe a little bit, but I have seen that over the years. So it seems to be a pretty broad definition when you look at that. It's a little more of a legal definition, and it is something that each church has to make a decision on whether you qualify or not. So the board, so in terms of housing allowances, and this is a big benefit for ministers, they are able to exclude from their compensation anything that is spent and we'll get into this in a minute in terms of what qualifies as a housing expense. Any qualified housing expenses can be excluded from their compensation. So for example, if a pastor is receiving $50,000 in overall compensation, a portion of that can be allocated to housing expenses. And if that's done, that's a big benefit for the minister, especially if you have a spouse that's working, you're able to take a good chunk of your income and not pay federal or state tax on it. It is still subject to self-employment tax. So that is something that's in play, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But the first step involved with the church board is designating a portion of your compensation, and it has to be done up front. And this is always the tricky part because, you have a general idea what your mortgage payments are, what your utilities are, your home insurance, and so forth. But you didn't know you're going to buy a big refrigerator or a big ticket expense item later in the year. That's the problem. You have to kind of figure all that out ahead of time. It's similar to some of these flex spending accounts where you've got to decide how much you're going to spend up front. If you don't spend it, you lose it. That's kind of the concept of it. Generally speaking, it's a good idea to overestimate because if you decided to designate, let's say, $20,000 of the $50,000 compensation in my example as a housing allowance, if let's say you only spend 15 of that, the other five is taxable and that's okay. So it's better to overestimate rather than underestimate. You have to be reasonable about it. And the reason why you have to be reasonable about it is because you just can't say, I'm going to spend $50,000 in housing expenses. The reason for that is the rules are that you can only designate on your tax return what is either what you actually spend or the fair market value of renting your house or the amount that was actually designated. So those three items, you get the lower of those three. So if, for example, it's $10,000 is what you can rent your house out for, $10,000, you actually designated 12 and you actually spent 15. Well, you can only deduct the lower of those three. The $10,000 is the fair market value of the rent of your home. So just kind of keep that in mind. I would say that generally speaking, that doesn't become a problem. So, yeah, Tammy.
Does the fair market value to rent your home also include the furnishings?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have to look at that. And that's kind of hard. That's one of those things that's a little hard to figure out. You might have to get a realtor involved. I would say in practice, most ministers don't have an issue with this. It usually ends up just being what was designated versus what did you actually spend. So it's usually not an issue for them from that standpoint. But that's just something to keep in mind. I think sometimes that is not mentioned. I would say probably generally speaking, it's not mentioned. In my experience, most ministers have not heard of that particular rule. But again, the challenge up front is just trying to figure out what you're going to be spending on your housing allowance. And who knows what your housing expenses are going to be. Some are predictable and some aren't. So that's just something to keep in mind. It has to be done proactively, not retroactively. So if you get to the middle of the year and you know what, I'm going to be buying a new refrigerator. I need an extra $1,200, whatever it might be. If you're going to go over your housing allowance that was originally designated, it's too late at that point. You can't go back to the board and ask for that. It has to be done up front. So a lot of the boards will do these designations in December to get you ready for January 1 start date. Okay, so just something to keep in mind with that. So it's always better, I think, as a general rule to guess higher rather than lower. So if you think you're going to spend 15, just put 18 in there. You're not going to hurt yourself doing that. So if you end up only spending $14,000, don't worry about it. You'll just have to pay tax on that additional amount. You would have anyway. So just something to keep in mind with that. So the next question, of course, is what qualifies as a housing allowance expense? And generally speaking, it's going to be rent if you're renting your place. It's going to be utilities, which, heat, electric, gas, basic telephone, water, garbage, things like that. Furniture, appliances. So again, that goes back to if you're going to be buying some new rugs or new living room furniture, try to guess that ahead of time if you can, or you'll have to wait till the next year if you want to include it in your housing allowance. It includes any insurance on the home, repairs, improvements, upkeep of the home, of the contents of the home, snow removal, lawn and mowing, lawn mowing, and things like that. So it doesn't include groceries. Some of that's probably pretty intuitive, but it's just really whatever you need for upkeep of your home. There's you can Google that and look at a long list of expenses. I've just captured maybe the broader 90% of them, but there's a small 10% that'll fall in there that might fit your situation. But it's not, you know, not dog food, not stuff like that. It's all what's needed to maintain your own home. So.
What about a big, like if you knew you were doing a kitchen renovation and you're mm-hmm. like, we're going to drop 20 grand this year on a kitchen. Like would that qualify? Would that justify mm-hmm. like essentially doubling your housing allowance for that year?
Yeah. If you're keeping in mind those, the rule up front, the lower the fair market value of your rent and what was designated and so forth. Sure. Yeah. So if you can rent your place for, you know, say 4,000 a month, and that's almost 50 grand. And you started out at 30 with your housing allowance. And you want to move it up another 20, that's fine. You can do that. But you just have to watch out with bumping into that rule. It's the lesser of the fair market value of the rental, the actual amount that was designated, and then the actual amount you actually spend. So you just have to watch out for that. But sure, you can do that. Yeah, that's very common. So once you get beyond that and you figure out what you're going to have for a housing allowance, this really becomes the real world stuff. And that is what you touched on, Darren, is making sure you're not going to have sticker shock in April. So it's really important, and I run into this a lot with new pastors at our church. I'm always very careful to do what we call a forecasted liability analysis, because I want to see what are your liabilities going to look like for the whole year. So we basically will prepare a 2023 1040 right now and forecast out all their income for that individual and their spouse. And so we can see what their tax return is going to look like basically right now here in June. And then we can look and see, what are you withholding? Oh, you're withholding 8,000. Well, your liability is about 12. So you're short 4 grand. That gives you, you know, a good 8, 9, 10 months running head start to get caught up and not be caught 4 weeks before the deadline, knowing you owe an extra 3 or 4 grand. So it's important to really stay on top of that. you can make estimated payments. That's one option. Or you can have the tax liability withheld from your pay, like you always have if you've had a normal W-2 job in the past. Generally speaking, it's better to do it through the W-2 because it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, and you've allocated it over the remaining pay period. So that's a little easier to do it that way. And I'll talk in a minute about how to calculate that and what's involved with that. But that's how I would recommend you pay in your tax, is just through your W-2. Now, technically, churches are not required to withhold for pastors, but almost all of them will, and almost all of them do. So I would have your church do the withholding. It's a little cleaner that way and a little simpler.
Now, in that case, is the church making quarterly payments for you, or they're just holding it for April?
Yeah, what they're doing is they're withholding money from your pay, like this upcoming pay period, and they'll remit it to the government, to the IRS, and to the state usually by the 15th of the following month, unless they're on a different payment schedule.
Okay, so, my churches, I don't think I've ever had that. Mine have always, as part of the benefits package, I've generally gotten half of the, what do they call it? Half of the Social Security or something. So 7.5% is like a benefit. But that just comes to me as a quarterly check. Like, so 2 weeks before it's due, I get a check, but then I'm still responsible to submit it. So I've not had churches... Yeah, make payments for me. I've always had to keep, and that's definitely been a challenge for me at different times, is the, you know, keeping up with those estimated payments and making sure that you follow. Even if I've had an accountant tell me, here's what you better do, it's like it's an easy you can feel like you can cut that corner for now, but then you pay for it in April.
Yeah, no, that's a little bit of an uncommon way of doing it, where you actually get the check from the church. That's taxable to you, of course, but some churches will do that. They'll say, well, we know you're going to have to pay your one half or your full share of the CECA tax, they call it. CECA tax is self-employment tax. It's also interchangeable with FICA tax, self-employment tax. All those terms are interchangeable. So when I say FICA tax, I really mean CECA tax for ministers. But yeah, basically, you're on the hook for all of the CECA tax or FICA tax, which is 15.3%. And that's on your total compensation. That's on the full $50,000 in my original example. But you do pay federal and state tax only on the portion that is not the housing allowance. So I'll call it the salary portion of it. So if your salary portion is $30,000 and $20,000 is the housing allowance, you will pay federal and state tax on the $30,000 in my example, the salary portion. You will pay self-employment tax or CECA tax on the full $50,000. And you have to keep that in mind. That's, I think that's probably the area that traps most of the pastors, because the typical scenario that I've seen is you have a pastor that's making, let's just say $75,000. The spouse does not work. Generally speaking, their tax liability would have otherwise been relatively low when you're talking about federal tax. But when you throw in the self-employment tax on top of that, now you've got, you know, an extra $10,000, $12,000 in self-employment tax. And they're saying, wait, what? You know, they have no idea that that was coming. So that's a real eye-opener. And that's part of that forecasted liability analysis we do to make sure they understand, you know, you're not just paying federal and state tax on your salary only. It's on, it's going to be on that salary, but you're also paying self-employment tax on the full amount you of your compensation. So
but the thing that changed at some point, because, you know, we, our four boys have grown up and we got three in college now. The thing that changed was the child tax credit.
Yeah.
So I remember when I first started, we were feeling that 15%, and that was just, but then at some point, I guess early 2000s, mid, like the child tax credit kicked in and we kept having more kids. And so that was just a huge benefit. But what nobody told me was the year your child turns 16, you lose that. So yeah. I don't know what if the government's like, hey, they should be working, get them out to McDonald's, you know, and they're chipping in for the taxes on their own. But that was something I just wasn't prepared for. Nobody told me, but it's a nice benefit when you have it.
I would generally say that most ministers have very, very low federal tax liability, if not zero, because the child tax credit wipes that out. That's generally speaking. And by the way, I'll throw in here at this point, too, that if you have an IRA, an existing IRA, a traditional IRA, and you're in that situation where you have no tax liability, federal tax liability I'm talking about now, not including self-employment tax, you have no tax liability, you ought to be thinking about doing a Roth conversion and bringing some of that into income where you won't pay any tax on it. So talk to your financial advisor about or your tax accountant about that. But if you have no federal tax liability, you ought to be thinking about doing that. So the self-employment tax really is what comes after federal tax on the tax return, which federal tax is usually very low. And then you see this big number for self-employment tax and you say, what is this? And it represents the self-employment tax on all of your compensation, salary, and housing allowance. So that's the big eye-opener for a lot of new pastors that you have to watch out for. And I think generally after the first, year or two, you get used to it. You sort of digest it and you understand what the drill is. And you make sure that you have enough withheld going forward. Tammy, you mentioned about your W-2, I think, maybe, or you were talking about your housing allowance and how that might have got messed up in terms of how it was presented. I will also say that, again, a lot of churches, especially small ones, don't have any idea about a lot of these rules, especially the tax reporting for pastors. The church is not required to pay that self-employment tax or that SECA tax. That's all on the minister. Having said that, a lot of the smaller churches still pay it. And when they do, they will add that to your compensation, just like they do for Darren. And then you'll at least be, they call it being grossed up. They'll gross up your income to kind of cover that half of the tax, just to kind of help you out. Because if you had a normal, you know, job, a non-minister job on the marketplace, you'd be paying your share of the FICA tax, which is 7.65%. We probably all worked a job where we had to do that. But when you become a minister, you are considered self-employed. And so you have to pay the full 15.3%, not just your share of 7.65. So that's something to keep in mind. And you'll get kind of a strange looking W-2. You'll see your W-2 doesn't look like the W-2 that you got when you worked at McDonald's. It'll have an amount in box one for the gross wages, which are excluding the housing allowance. It'll have in box two your federal taxes withheld if the church is doing that for you, and they should. That's a little. I'd say most often that happens more than 90% of the time. Boxes three and five, which are your Social Security and Medicare wages, will be zero. It's a strange presentation. Again, that goes back to because the church is not responsible for paying Social Security or Medicare taxes for you. That's on you. So they will also have in box 14, which is a memo box. And that box 14 will have in it, and it should, the word housing allowance, and it'll tell you what it is. So it'll say housing allowance, $20,000. Now you need that because when you prepare your return, it's going to show 30,000 in box one, which is your normal compensation. But if you're preparing the return or a CPA is preparing, they're going to look at it and go, what's your housing allowance? And you might say, well, I don't remember. I have no idea. And then you got to go back and talk to your church or whatever it might be. But that's not self-evident when you look at a W-2. You have to have something in box 14. That's where it's almost always listed to indicate what the housing allowance portion of it is. So something that I think is important for new pastors to do is to get some guidance from a CPA or someone that knows what they're doing. I would say that, I don't know, maybe 50-50 of my colleagues know about minister's taxes. The other half don't or don't have a clue about it, and they just don't work with it. I've worked with it over the years, and I can tell you up front, it was early on going, wait, this is how it's done, really? And it's just a weird presentation, weird reporting, but that's just the way the tax laws are. And so you'll need to find someone that at least understands it well enough to give you guidance on it. So I think one of the last topics we wanted to talk about was possibly opting out of Social Security. And, you know, I would tell you that generally speaking over three decades plus, I would say that's definitely the exception, not the general rule. It's not right or wrong. It's just that it's a personal decision you have to make. It's almost like what color car do you want? Everybody's going to decide on that choice themselves. And there's implications in doing that because once you make the election, you can't go back. And if you decide to opt out of Social Security and you're on your own to track your own retirement and put money away for it. And when you get to be old enough to otherwise draw Social Security, you're not going to be able to. And so that's something to keep in mind. And you better have money set up and set aside. It's difficult for a pastor, as it is with the compensation level they get, to be thinking about putting money away for retirement. Most of them are just, you know, trying to survive and support their family. So it becomes a difficult situation. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend doing it, but it's not wrong. It's just that if you did do it, make sure you're planning for it. That's all. So
the way it was presented to me was if you choose to not go into Social Security, you're essentially claiming a religious conviction against insurance. I mean, that was how it's like, you have this convictional thing that you don't believe in insurance. And so in my mind, it was like, if you're not going to pay into Social Security, you're basically saying, I'm not going to have insurance at all. And I've known a few pastors who have opted out of Social Security, but they do carry regular insurance. And I've just felt like that's kind of an inconsistency. And it, you know, just from a ethical standpoint, like if you're making that claim, you really got to think through what you're telling the government and then what you're actually going to do. And I don't guess the government chases you down to, you know, check and see what your insurance benefits are, but that's the way I've understood. Is that the way it's presented legally? It's like a convictional.
Yeah, that's right. And there's an application. I think it's form 4361, if I remember right. You have to actually fill that out, and you're checking all those boxes and you're signing it to indicate that. And there's no going back. They did have back in, I think, early 2000s Congress, because a lot of pastors are saying, I'm not sure we made the right decision here. Can you let us unwind this? And back in 2000, they actually did do that for a time. They had a little open window for you to be able to go, all right, we'll do a do-over. I'll get back on Social Security. And they talked about it recently in the past few years, but to my knowledge, nothing's open right now to be able to do that. So that's just something to keep in mind. Again, it's not a right or wrong thing, but I would just say that most don't do it. The obvious tax savings are that, in my example, the $50,000, then you would not be paying 15.3% in SECA tax or FICA tax on that. So that's the main benefit. And I think sometimes pastors, some of them do, when they see that, they'll go, wow, that's a huge tax savings. But you better be putting that money aside or a good chunk of it aside for retirement. So that's just something to keep in mind. It's also good to get hooked up with a financial advisor who, again, has your full financial picture in mind and looks at your whole objectives rather than just me saying, here's what I think you got to do from a tax standpoint. They'll look at whether you can afford it, what you want to retire on, how much you need to retire and all that. And it's good to do that from the very beginning. A lot of the financial advisors that I know will do that either at no charge or discounted rate to help you out as a minister, certainly getting started. And so I do see a lot of my minister clients working with financial advisors directly and not really trying to do it themselves.
Well, and within the EFCA, we have the great blessing of FCMM. And so that's an easy and free phone call for any EFCA pastor or ministry leader to call FCMM, schedule an appointment, and they will definitely work with you to, if you're not set up with them, you know, they'll help you get set up and, but they'll give advice on all this. So that's been helpful for me through all the different churches where I've been and, but just keeping my retirement in FCMM and then different churches I've served. This is just a word for, you know, local church elders and local church deacons and stuff as they're making salary packages. One of the best policies at churches where I've served is having a matching retirement program. So like right now I get a guaranteed 2%. So my church is going to put 2% directly to FCMM, but they'll match up to another 2% at 50%. So if I put in 4, I get an extra 2 on top of the 2. So I can have then 8% that's going and the church is matching. And so that's just a huge incentive. And it's one of those like, man, if I could rewind, that's what my FCM advisor would say. If I could rewind and having started doing that when I was 22 and just starting, like, okay. But yeah, that's my little exhortation to churches and pastors, you know, just start thinking about retirement right away. Pastors are hugely guilty of just not planning that far in the future. So.
Yeah, that's what I see on W-2s as well. It's a great idea. It's a great point there. And I think that if your church offers a 403b plan, even if they don't, you should tell them to offer it. It really costs them nothing to do that or very little. And it's a great way for, again, it goes back to the out of sight, out of mind, putting your federal and state taxes withheld, have that withheld from your check as opposed to estimated payments, out of sight, out of mind, doing a 403b, even if it's a small amount, it's a good discipline to get into. And as the kids get older, you can start to put more away. But it's just a good discipline to get in early on in your life because retirement will be here before you know it. So good idea from that standpoint.
This has been so helpful. Thank you so much, Michael. I needed you a couple of years ago. I really do. I really did. That would have been a much smoother process for me. So thank you so much for giving your time today.
Sure. Happy to help out.
And Mike, where would you send someone to get more information?
Well, I think, you know, if you can find someone local in your church, it seems like every church is going to have a CPA working there or a tax preparer. See if you can put a bug in their ear to maybe help out the pastors at church. Our firm prepares new pastors that come on board from Trinity and other colleges. We prepare the returns at no charge. We also give them these forecasted liabilities in the fall. Analysis in the fall to make sure that they're withholding enough and on track. And so if you can find someone in your church that will do that at no charge, or maybe put a bug in their ear and say, hey, you know, maybe as a part of your ministry, you can do tax returns for these two or three pastors in our church. And maybe that's a good way to do it. So that's one place to start. Otherwise you'd have to find someone local that understands minister tax rules and get connected with them.
And there was a website you mentioned before we started recording, clergy something.
Yeah, there's a Clergy Financial up in Minnesota. I've used them before for some advanced tax issues that are related to ministers. And I found them to be very, very experienced. They know what they're doing. I think their rates are pretty reasonable in terms of like an hourly consultation rate. So if you've got questions, you can call them up. My questions usually are, you know, a 2-minute question, but I pay for the full hour. But they're very good. And so that's, it's up and you can just Google it, Clergy Financial up in Minnesota. And again, there's a lot of them out there. So if you just Google, minister assistance or minister tax preparation, I'm sure you'll get, you know, dozens of hits. But finding a local person that knows tax issues, is usually the best route to go if you can do that. Cause then you develop a personal relationship.
That's what I've done. I've been fortunate to have guys like you, you know, directly just say, hey, give me your stuff. And that, yeah. That's helpful. But yeah, I have a CPA in my church who helps me down here. So that's helpful. But, and then the other thing that we ran into, as a benefit, child tax credit, that goes away, kids turn 16, but the college expense, thing, I don't know what that's called, but that's been super helpful for us with three kids in college. That's helped defray a lot of those costs in this stage of life.
That kind of comes in and sort of replaces that for you, the child tax credit. The child tax credit actually just is reduced. It doesn't go away, at least at this point. point in the tax law. The 2021 tax year was a very generous child tax credit, and it was reduced in 22. And they're talking right now, actually, in Congress of in the new tax rules that will come out this year, of maybe going back and increasing that again as a bargaining chip for the Democrats versus what the Republicans want. So it's possible that might get increased again this year. But yeah, you're right. The education credit comes in. And that's where you have to be careful, because when that goes away, when your child is 21, 22 years old, you got to be careful, because you're going right back and you're going to lose, you know, $1,500, $2,000, depending on how many kids are in college. That's a big chunk of money. So just keep that in mind as well. Yeah,
we do. Lord willing, we have two graduating. And I assume that's a college thing. So grad school, they're not going to help with that, right?
Right. Yeah, there's a different credit for it, but yeah, mostly the bigger credit is for the American okay. Opportunity Tax Credit. Yeah.
Very good. Well, thanks so much, Mike. We really appreciate you taking the time and sharing with us. And on behalf of Free Church pastors everywhere, we're grateful for good tax advice. So sure. Good. Tammy, thanks for chiming in on this topic. And keep an eye on the FCA Network podcast for future episodes like this.
Thank you.